The book is called Triple Cross: How Bin Laden's Master Spy Penetrated the CIA, the Green Berets, and the FBI, written by Peter Lance. I got it a couple of days ago thinking, hey, I'll just read it on Saturday, wade through it, be ready for the show. This is not a book that is an easy read, and it's so dense, so packed with stuff that you really got to take your time and absorb all the information in it. I mean, footnoted as much as any book that I've read in many years, and it is an excellent work. But as I said at the top of this program, it's depressing in a sense. Peter Lance is the guy who wrote it. He's a five-time Emmy-winning investigative reporter, now working as a screenwriter and novelist. He was also a member of the first American crew into Indochina after the end of the Vietnam War. He's chased rebel insurgents, members of the Gambino crime family, and following the 9/11 attacks, he began investigating the origins of the FBI's probe of the World Trade Center bomber, Ramzi Ahmed Youssef. And now he is writing about how America's intelligence services sort of fumbled the pursuit of terrorists, paving the way for 9/11 to happen. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Hey, George, great to be with you.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation. This is a heck of a book.
Well, thank you. I hope you don't think it's too depressing. I mean, I try and move the pages, and my whole purpose in writing this book is to see that the FBI reforms. So it has a noble purpose, and it's fairly, the new edition, the trade paperback, which we can get into, Patrick Fitzgerald tried to kill, we'll get into that. Came out at June 16th, but I actually updated it as recently as the end of April. So it's pretty fresh. There's a lot of information that's quite fresh.
Yeah, I don't want to say it's depressing. It's not a downer of a book, but I mean, it made me so far, and I haven't finished it yet, but it's made me just mad. And I
Yeah.
think that's probably the reaction you're looking for.
Absolutely. Anger is the way people come away from this book, because you see dozens and dozens of opportunities. From 20 years ago this week, the FBI Special Operations Group followed a group of Middle Eastern men from a mosque in Brooklyn, and of the men they photographed over 4 weekends, three were later convicted in the Trade Center bombing, one killed Rabbi Meir Kahane, two were convicted by Patrick Fitzgerald in the Day of Terror case in 95. So you see how years earlier the FBI was onto these guys and, for reasons unknown, dropped the ball. And that's just the first of many examples.
I want to start at the end of the story, and that's the stuff that happened this week. You just briefly mentioned it. Patrick Fitzgerald, tell the audience who he is. I mean, this is a heavyweight guy, and this week you basically, I mean, literally told him, put up or shut up. If you're going to
Right.
threaten to sue me for libel, let's see it.
Right, exactly. Patrick Fitzgerald, and I want to start off by saying that I have tremendous respect for him, for the convictions that he's done when he's convicted corrupt politicians and mobsters and terrorists. That's all God's work, and bully for Patrick. And he's a brilliant man. He went to Harvard Law School. He's the son of an immigrant Irish doorman in New York. Has had a stellar career. But when I started writing these books, George, of which this book is the third in a series for HarperCollins, I focused in this last book on Al-Qaeda's master spy, Ali Mohammed, and I began to uncover multiple instances in which Fitzgerald, who was really the effective general in the war on terror up until 9/11, because, as you know, it was a series of legal cases investigated by the New York office of the Bureau and prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District, the great office that begat Giuliani and Louis Freeh. And Patrick Fitzgerald was effectively the general in that war on terror. And I found multiple instances where he was either negligent or literally, at one point, I believe, purposefully discredited key Al-Qaeda intelligence. And so when I brought that out, the book came out in 06. It was out for 11 months. And just when we were preparing to do the paperback, he sent the first of four letters to HarperCollins threatening to sue for libel. The most recent one was as recently as June 2nd. Literally wanted to take all hardcover copies within the company's control and have them destroyed, prevent this paperback from seeing the light of day, and literally put us through an extraordinary process where we went back and revetted the entire book, every single fact, not just the material on Fitzgerald. So it was really daunting and, frankly, I believe, inappropriate for a sitting U.S. official to try and use the civil libel laws to suppress a book critical of his performance in office.
When I think of Patrick Fitzgerald, I think of one of the good guys. I got to tell
you. Yeah, most people do. And I think that, and as I said, he has been on the side of the angels. I mean, recently indicting Governor Blagojevich, although we have to remain neutral on the guilt or innocence until that trial takes place. But Patrick Fitzgerald has had a stellar record. However, there's no official, and he's worked for four separate presidential administrations. So he worked for Bush 41, Clinton, Bush 43, and now Obama. And in the course of his career, I focused particularly on his tenure as first co-head and later head of the Organized Crime and Terrorism Unit. He wore two hats in the Southern District. And furthermore, starting in January of 96, George, he was effectively running Squad I-49, which was the bin Laden squad in the New York office of the Bureau, seeking an indictment of bin Laden, which, again, is a good purpose. And there were four agents in that squad, and one in particular, Jack Clunan, gave me extensive interviews for this book. And I began to – my jaw started to drop as I began to see, you know, what contrasted with the image of Fitzgerald. Vanity Fair did this famous kind of fawning piece about him, Mr. Fitz Goes to Washington in 06, in which they said he had scary, smart intelligence. He's the bin Laden brain, the mainframe computer brain of Patrick Fitzgerald, et cetera. And what I saw was in such a contrast to that, I reported in the book, but apparently he didn't like it because he literally tried to have this book killed.
So he's made these threats before, as recently as June. He's been making them, I guess, for a couple of years now. Do you consider them to be hollow threats? I mean, you came out this week and said, put up or shut up, basically daring him to come after you.
Yeah, well, first of all, no one invites litigation. Anyone who's been involved, and I have a law degree, and I understand what litigation can be. But and by the way, if you don't mind me from time to time mentioning my website, on my website, which is Peter Lance, my name, peterlance.com, not only do I have, you can download all 32 pages of threat letters, you can download HarperCollins' response rejecting his claim. I filed a complaint with the Department of Justice a few weeks ago, which you can download. But let me just explain my analysis of the libel laws. And any investigative reporter has to know the law of libel very well, because the kind of work that we do always has the potential to injure someone's reputation. Now, typically in the law, defamation is the broad term. Libel is spoken published or broadcast defamation, and slander is verbal defamation. Okay. So what I've done is I'm a book writer, so my book isn't published, and so Patrick Fitzgerald was threatening in these letters to sue for libel. Now, fortunately, truth is always an absolute defense. So if you say something about someone's reputation, it's true, they cannot sue for libel. They can sue, but they're not going to win. And this is very important. There's a landmark case called New York Times versus Sullivan, and it's the standard all of us live by. From the time I was at Columbia J School in the early 70s, and I took absence of malice. You have to prove, and this is very important. And it's the reason the Supreme Court found this ruling was because they wanted to encourage the vigorous coverage of public officials and public figures, that even if a person has something wrong, if a reporter has a fact that's wrong, as long as he does not demonstrate reckless disregard for the truth, defined as actual malice, then the public official cannot effectively litigate the claim. Now, you said it. You've held the book in your hand. You're a great witness to the meticulous level of documentation in this book. There, in the original edition, in hardcover, it was 604 pages. There were 1,420 endnotes, 32 pages of documentary appendices, which, by the way, people can download from peterlance.com, and they can download. There's a 32-page timeline in the middle of the book that I think would be very helpful to your listeners, because as we get into the story tonight, it's an epic, complicated story, but this timeline is very visual, so you can get that at peterlance.com. So all of this was in the book, and yet in his most recent letter on June 2nd, Patrick Fitzgerald actually said, George, quote, he didn't say the entire book, but he said the book is, quote, a deliberate lie masquerading as the truth. Now, to tar a book of this level of complexity in depth as in just kind of one line of saying the entire book is a lie, to me, is a reckless statement that you would not expect from a lawyer, much less a federal prosecutor.
Peter, I'm sorry I'm going to have to interrupt you. We need to take a break right at this point.
Sure.
When we come back, I want you to get started as well into the story of who this guy Muhammad Ali, Ali Muhammad is, and it's a fascinating tale. Stay with us for more of our interview with Peter Lance here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. My name is George Knapp. I'm talking with Peter Lance, author of the book Triple Cross, about Osama bin Laden's master spy. Peter, before the break, we were talking about these letters written by a federal prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, threatening to sue you and come after you if this book is not pulled off the shelves. I notice I downloaded the letters and printed them out. They're written as a private citizen. They're not on stationery from the U.S. Attorney's Office, right?
Right, except that after he sent his first letter of 9 pages on October 11th, and when you download the letters, you get the response from Mark Jackson, who was then the attorney at HarperCollins. By the way, I only had one factual error in the entire book, and that was there was a misdating of an MSNBC article that I referred to that even to this day, if you go to the website, is still misdated. So it was clearly an inadvertent error in all that of 604 pages of documentation. And we said, Mark Jackson said, we're going to correct that. Mr. Fitzgerald also, in our view, misinterpreted the meaning of a particular sentence on, I think, page 209 of the original book. And we said we would reword it so that he would not, you know, no one else would misinterpret the meaning of it. But basically, we said we're going forward. And Mark Jackson called the book an important work of investigative journalism. Now, Patrick Fitzgerald then, on November 16th, 2 weeks later, sent a 16-page letter, and in this case, he faxed it from the, it says, Office of U.S. Attorney Chicago at the top. I mean, you know, I don't think that was a mistake. Now, when Michael Isikoff of Newsweek broke the story of Fitzgerald's censorship attempt to kill the book on June 8th in Newsweek, Fitzgerald said that it was inadvertent, that he wasn't aware that the timestamp on the fax would be there. But query whether here, I think this is the most important thing. If anybody wants to go to peterlance.com, and George, you looked at the letters, you have to ask yourself, because they do go from over 20 months, what is Patrick Fitzgerald, the man charged with protecting the people of the Northern District of Illinois, how much time did he spend reading Triple Cross and then sending these detailed 32 pages worth of letters? And if he didn't do this himself, did he have one of the 161 lawyers in his office do it? And if he did, that really would have crossed the line. So the question is, why is this man so obsessed with killing this book? And I want to ask you, think about this now. You're a man that covers current events, and I ask your listeners too, can anyone in your within the sound of your voice remember an example of any kind of U.S. official on this level ever attempting to kill a book critical of their performance in office? If you go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, there are dozens of books by people who hated Clinton, right, or vice versa, people that hated Bush, or not just hated them either, but were critical of their administrations, right? And you know, when it's almost unprecedented for especially a federal prosecutor on the level of Fitzgerald to try and use the civil libel laws. And so because of this New York, I'm going to answer the question. It took a while to answer your question. You said, Peter, did you not think he had a case? You know, you said, but my recent Huffington Post, I said, put up or shut up. Yeah, because I don't think Fitzgerald being brilliant, he knows the New York Times versus Sullivan standard. He knows that rule. So he didn't have a viable case back in the fall of 07 when he began this campaign. He knew he didn't have it, but he kept pursuing it. And I, in the new introduction, in the new book, the trade paperback, which is like 40 pages, I think it's 26 pages longer, because I take many of Fitzgerald's critiques in his letters and I address them in the book. I have an anecdote from my law school days. One of the early memories I have at Fordham University School of Law was who's now a federal judge, McLaughlin, Dean Joseph McLaughlin. And he said to us one day, he said, okay, this is my general advice to you young law students. If you're in court and you don't have it on the facts, pound on the law. If you don't have it on the law, pound on the facts. And if you don't have it on the facts or the law, pound on the table. Well, I think Patrick Fitzgerald engaged in table pounding in those 20 months. He was trying to use his weight, the presence of who he was, even though he wrote Patrick Fitzgerald, Private Citizen, he's trying to use who he was to intimidate HarperCollins. And keep in mind, this, in my opinion, is his third incursion on the First Amendment. First of all, during his tenure as special prosecutor in the CIA leak case, he got Judith Miller, a New York Times reporter, no matter what you may think of her coverage on the road to Iraq, whether you like her or dislike her, no journalist deserves to go to prison or jail. And he put that woman away. He got her, put away by a judge for 85 days when he knew the identity of a leaker, Richard Armitage, already before she went to jail. Next, he pursued her cell phone records and those of New York Times reporter Phil Sheehan for months and months and months. And it went all the way up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. And he actually succeeded in getting their cell phone records in another a case called the Islamic Charities case. So in my opinion, this is his third incursion against the First Amendment. And he takes an oath to uphold the Constitution. And the First Amendment guarantees the freedom of the press. In fact, my job is to audit the Patrick Fitzgeralds of the world. So what is he doing trying to bury or pulp or kill a book critical of his performance in office?
Well, I can see one thing that that he writes about that would be pretty upsetting to a U.S. attorney. He says that you charged him with filing a false affidavit with a federal judge to conceal the purported fact that the fatal crash of TWA 800 was really a terrorist attack and that he'd been tipped in advance by organized crime figures. I can see how he'd be, if that in fact is what you say in the book, that he'd be pretty upset about that.
Well, see, this is classic Fitzgerald in the way he strings words together. First of all, when he most recently he gave an interview to the Associated Press in which he said Peter Lance blames me in the book for the deaths of 9/11 in the African embassy. I didn't even come close to that anywhere in the book. And yes, I allege in the book that he filed a sworn affirmation. And the sworn affirmation discredited what I believe to be very credible al-Qaeda-related intelligence gathered over an 11-month period in 1996. And I really would like to get into the specifics of that. In fact, I wrote a piece for Playboy, and George, I'm sure you're shocked to know that they do have articles in Playboy,
But, I've heard that, yeah.
Yeah, and so I wrote this piece called The Chilling Effect. It was on Playboy.com. You can link it at peterlance.com, my website, and I detail specifically that issue of this affirmation that he signed. But I don't say anything. I talk about TWA 800 in another part of the book, but I don't make the link between that affirmation and I don't call it a false affirmation. If he says false affidavit, the
false
actual
affidavit.
Legal term of art is affirmation. It was dated June 25th, and it's an appendix. You can find it. If you have the book in front of you, it's on page 590, I believe, or 591 of the book. But see, what he does is he strings together a series of things in the book and then makes it a false allegation. But guess what? Even though he libeled me in that AP story, he made a false statement about what I said about him in the book. And that's libelous to me. But guess what? I wouldn't sue Patrick Fitzgerald for libel because I don't believe the civil libel laws should be used to interdict debate. We should have the pot of a democracy should be stirred regularly by people of opposing points of view. And I would never use the civil libel laws to do what he tried to do. So, anyway, that's an area. That affirmation, by the way, and I really would like to get into it at some point if we can. We have the 3 hours to get into.
Oh yeah, I mean, if this is about TWA 800 being a terrorist attack, yeah, I'd like to get into that.
Yeah, I have, and I've spoken with George Norrie about this at length. One of my theories, and it's a theory that I think I've established at least by a civil standard, which is a preponderance of the evidence. I have. Believe that TWA 800 was Bojinka fulfilled. It was an attempt by Ramzi Youssef. It was on trial at the time for a plot to blow up a series of U.S. jumbo jets entering the country. I believe that the crash of TWA 800 was a bomb, a terrorist bomb, not a missile, but I believe it was an act of terror. And I believe
I'll tell you what, I'm sorry to interrupt you right there. You were on a roll, but we're going to have to take a break, and we'll come back to that for sure, because that's something of interest to our audience. We're talking with Peter Lance, author of the book Triple Cross, Stay with us, everyone. When we come back, we're going to introduce you to this character, Ali Mohammed, and he is a chilling character indeed. We're talking with Peter Lance, the author of this book, Triple Cross. And as I mentioned at the top of the program, I mean, you read it and your jaw drops. I mean, the central character is this guy, Ali Mohammed, who had clear ties to bin Laden. He had ties to the group that assassinated Anwar Sadat. He was kicked out of the Egyptian military for being too much of a radical. So you know how radical he has to be for that to happen. And then he gets into this country, doesn't hide. He joins the army and gets posted to this classified facility here. It's astonishing. So we've been talking about the legalities surrounding Peter Lance and his efforts to get this book published and keep it out there. When we come back, we jump into the meat of the story. We meet this character, Ali Mohammed, and start tracking his trail in our country. And I got a feeling you're going to be just as angry as I was when you hear this story. Stay with us for more of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Our guest, Peter Lance, author of Triple Cross, How Bin Laden's Master Spy Penetrated the CIA, Green Berets, and the FBI. Peter, let's introduce your main character here, Ali Mohammed. I would imagine you have to be a pretty radical guy to get kicked out of the Egyptian army.
Yeah, Ali Mohammed is absolutely one of the most extraordinary characters. There are actually two in this epic story. And again, if you don't mind me mentioning, if people go to peterlance.com, in the upper right corner, you can download right now a PDF of this timeline, this 32-page timeline. And while Triple Cross focuses largely on Ali Mohammed, the other extraordinary figure is Ramzi Youssef. And as you know, George, for any great military operation to succeed, when I say great, I'm not trying to praise Al Qaeda. I'm just saying for any military operation to succeed, you need operations. You need people on the ground blowing things up, or in the sky blowing things up, and you need intelligence. And as Ramzi Youssef was the great bomb operations guy for Al Qaeda, the mastermind, I prove in my book that Ramzi Youssef was the absolute mastermind, not just of the original Trade Center bombing, but of the 9/11 plot, that it was merely carried out by his uncle, let me emphasize, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind, is now in Guantanamo, and that, in fact, Ali Mohammed was the intelligence officer, and he was in the unit that killed Anwar Sadat. Only he escaped scrutiny at the time because he happened to be in the U.S. on an exchange program, officer exchange program. But Ali Mohammed was soon kicked out of the Egyptian military by President Mubarak, who succeeded Sadat because of his radical views. He then was adopted by Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri. And al-Zawahiri was jailed after the Sadat assassination and was kind of like the spokesman for the group every night. And on my timeline, you'll see a picture. The second picture, the third picture shows him in a jail cell, al-Zawahiri. He used to give interviews every night to the press. And when he got out, he founded the Islamic Egyptian Jihad, which later became merged with al-Qaeda, with bin Laden to form al-Qaeda. So Ali Mohammed became his kind of pet spy, if you will, and al-Zawahiri was his sheikh. And Ali Mohammed in 1984 approached the CIA in Cairo to see if he could, you know, infiltrate the CIA. And they were hungry for our Islamic speakers at the time because, as you know, the CIA, there had been the Marine barracks bombing in December of 83, and that in the spring there had been the detonation, the explosion of the U.S. embassy with a truck bomb. So they were really hungry to get Arab-speaking people. So Ali goes into according to this FBI agent, Jack Clunan, I interviewed, who went back and kind of put the case together on Ali. He goes into this mosque in Hamburg on behalf of the CIA, supposedly blows his cover, and gets put on a watch list, but somehow mysteriously ends up at Fort Bragg, getting on a plane, coming into the U.S., a TWA flight, and he seduces an American woman named Linda Sanchez on the flight. They get married at a drive-through wedding chapel in Reno. Now they're living in Silicon Valley, where he sets up a sleeper cell, and he enlists in the U.S. Army, only to end up at the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare School at Fort Bragg, where the elite Green Beret officers train.
Well, I mean, this can't be an accident. He's got to have somebody helping him, doesn't he?
Well, his commanding officer, Anderson, who we interviewed, absolutely believe he had help. In fact, and he said, I don't know if it was the CIA or the FBI, but he, remember, you have to understand the background. The background was that we helped the Mujahideen. We were supporting the Mujahideen in the fight against the evil empire, the Soviets. And the CIA provided at least $3 billion in covert aid, matched dollar for dollar by the Saudis. And in fact, later, when they turned, you know, after the war, after the successful, you know, after the Soviets were dispatched in February, Bin Laden and al-Zawahiri decided to use the worldwide fundraising organization called the MAK, the Office of Service for the Mujahideen, to continue their jihad against America. They turned on us, and Ali Mohammed became their principal espionage agent. So he's at Fort Bragg, and during that, did he get past the watch list because somebody in the CIA wanted to do a favor for the guy who had helped us at one point? I don't know, but I'll tell you this. He told Colonel Anderson, I'm going to go and fight in Afghanistan during my leave. And he said, you can't do that. You're active duty, and we're not supposed to be there. That's like Francis Gary Powers getting shot down in the U-2. We're not supposed to be doing those flights. A big embarrassment to President Eisenhower. And Ali defied him, went to Afghanistan. It's claimed on his return that he killed two Soviet Spetsnaz commandos and actually threw their belts down on Anderson's desk like war trophies. Anderson told us that he recommended an immediate court-martial, and the IG, the JAG guy, said, no, we don't have enough on him. I mean, come on. So somebody was protecting Ali Mohammed, there's no doubt.
There he is at Fort Bragg. He's a supply sergeant. He doesn't have a security clearance, but he gets access to all kinds of secret stuff while he's there. Is that right?
Well, yeah, exactly. If you go to my website on the homepage, I'm looking at my website now. It's a little screwed up tonight because I updated it and I think I messed it up a little bit. But if you look at the homepage of my website, at least I'm looking at it with Firefox, and you go down on the right side under the timeline, which you can download, you'll see a thing that says secret and it's crossed out. And there's a series of declassified documents, which you can download. Well, those documents represent the appendix, 32 pages of appendix in the book. And the first document that you come to, George, is Appendix 1. It says El Sayed Nosir documents. Now, these were documents that were uncovered the night Rabbi Meir Kahane was murdered in 1990. And as I said, I contend that this is the first blood spilled by al-Qaeda on American soil. Kahane was killed at the Marriott Hotel by a radical Egyptian trained by Ali Mohammed. The FBI had photographed this guy, as I said, in the summer of 1989, 20 years earlier, 20 years earlier than today, but a year earlier than the murder. They actually photographed him using the same gun that he used to kill the rabbi. That night they went to his house and they pulled out 47 boxes of evidence, including this material. Now, the Arabic writing is apparently done by Ali Mohammed, but look at this document. It says location of selected units on December 5th of 88. All the special forces units in the world, Navy SEALs and Green Berets around the world with their latitude and longitude. Now, the Soviets would have paid $1 million for that at the height of the Cold War. You know, and here's Ali Mohammed, without a security clearance, able to obtain it, get it, and bring it into an al-Qaeda cell in New York.
Well, it sure seems like somebody was helping him, but it also would seem like at some point somebody has to realize this guy could be a double agent. He could be playing us here, especially in light of, as you describe, all the radical Islamic jihadist type stuff that he's always spouting.
Yeah, well, you know, the group that's currently having a convention in Chicago that's in the news, I'm going to try and pronounce their name properly so as not to, you know, to get big. There's a group in Chicago that basically advocates the worldwide dominance of Islam, the takeover by Islamic regimes of all governments in the world. And that group echoes Jama Islamiyah, and Jama Islamiyah is the group that was responsible for the Indonesian bombings last week. Okay, and their main thesis is that they want to have what's known as Dar ul Harb, which is a government in the state of democracy or a non-Islamic government. They want to change every government to what's known as Dar al Islam, or an Islamic government like you have in Iran. run by the mullahs. And Ali Muhammad actually made training tapes at Fort Bragg in which he talked about this. And he said, it's the goal of our Islam. And he spoke of it in as if he was representing it himself, even though he's a U.S. Army sergeant, a naturalized citizen who took an oath to America, and a U.S. Army sergeant who took a second oath to uphold the Constitution. So here is this guy describing his, views that we need to dominate the world with. And he talked about Egypt at the time, but he could easily have been talking about America, and that's treason by any way you slice it, to advocate the overthrow of a government to set up a pro-Islamic republic in a country is treasonous if you're in the United States with respect to our country.
At what point does he hook up that you know of, you can document that he hooks up with these guys who were responsible for the World Trade Center bombing?
Well, we know that he was coming up to New York. He was stationed at Bragg from 87 to 89, and he was coming up, we know for sure in 1989, because that surveillance that we have on the timeline at the top of page 3, there's actually a picture. If you could download the timeline from peterlance.com and you go to the top of page 3, you'll see a photograph that was introduced at the Day of Terror trial in 1995, Patrick Fitzgerald prosecuted, of one of the surveillance photos. And of the men photographed, as I said, 3 were convicted in the Trade Center bombing, 2 in this Day of Terror plot, and El Sayed Nasser killed Kahani. And so we know he trained all those guys. He operated out of a mosque on Atlantic Avenue called the El Farouk, and where the FBI followed these guys from. And he also would go to a mosque in Jersey City called the El Salam, ironically known as the Mosque of Peace. And so Ali Muhammad was all over these places. And he also, there's a fascinating story about a murder that took place that I compare to like an organized crime hit. And it was the murder of a guy named Mustafa Shalabi. Mustafa Shalabi was a redheaded Egyptian. He was a great devotee of a guy named Abdullah Azzam. And Azzam was the Palestinian scholar that founded this worldwide group, the Office of Services for the Mujahideen. And he set up centers all over the world. There were like a dozen in the U.S. The El Farouk was the main one in Brooklyn. And they were bringing in millions of dollars, George, for the fight in Afghanistan. Well, when the Soviets left in February, the money, the millions kept pouring in. So bin Laden and al-Zawahiri, who had formed al-Qaeda in 1988, and what does al-Qaeda mean? It really means database. It means base. But it refers to the database of names that they collected from all the brothers around the world, from the Philippines and South Africa and Chechnya, who came to fight the Soviets. That base became their network, if you will, the original Facebook of terrorism, if you will, that allowed them to create this worldwide network called Al-Qaeda. And Abdullah Azzam wanted to use the money, and so did Shalabi, his supporter, wanted to use the money for a pure Islamic government in Kabul, like the Taliban that eventually took over. But the bin Laden, surrounded by radical Egyptians, and this story is about Egyptian, Dr. al-Zawahiri, Mohammed Atef, the blind sheikh, Ali Muhammad, these are key figures around bin Laden. They wanted the funds to be used for the worldwide jihad, particularly to overthrow Mubarak in Egypt. So there was a coup d'etat within this organization, and Abdullah Azzam, in November of 89, is on his way to Juma prayers, Friday prayers, with his sons in a car, and it's blown up by a car bomb. And no one's ever, I don't know if anyone's ever found out whose fingerprints were on the bomb, but I think it's pretty clear bin Laden and company wanted this guy out of the way. And as soon as he got out of the way, the blind sheikh, the next year, the blind sheikh shows up in New York, starts dominating this mosque, the El Farouk, and he begins clashing with this guy, Shalabi. So Shalabi gets afraid. He starts telling people, I'm afraid. I'm a fear for my life. And he stupidly relies on Ali Muhammad, like Ali Muhammad's going to help him, right? And Ali Muhammad said, don't worry, I'll protect you. I'll help you go back to Egypt and you'll be safe. Well, he had a plane, the flight booked. He's ready to go to Egypt. The family is waiting in Cairo for him. He never arrives. George, guess what? The next day, somebody's walking in his house in Brooklyn in the Seagate section, and I have a picture of the house in the book on, let's see what page it's on, of the timeline, page five of the timeline. Yeah, and he is found bludgeoned, garroted, and stabbed. He's, like, murdered 3 different ways, and Ali Mohammed and a guy named Wadi El-Haj. And Wadi El-Haj is a Palestinian convert to Islam who later was convicted with Ali Mohammed in the embassy bombing plot. He and Ali were co-conspirators in the African embassy plot. Wadi El-Haj happens to be in New York at the time. He visited El-Sayed Nasir, the killer of Kahani at Rikers Island. I think, if I recall, they actually got his name, got his voice on the answering machine, and Shalabi is found holding a red hair in his hand. Now, that wasn't definitive, and at the time, nobody did any DNA testing, to my knowledge, but Mahmoud Abu Alima, another red-headed Egyptian, is one of the prime henchmen. It was at Calverton, photographed with the Bureau. He was the getaway driver for Nasser the night of the Kahani murder. He is another big, powerful figure in this story. Did he kill him? Did Ali Mohammed kill Shalabi? We don't know. That remains an unsolved homicide in New York. But if anybody decided to investigate, they might be able to go back and peel back the layers and find out.
Well, for sure, for certain, you could say Ali Mohammed didn't protect him as he said he would do.
Right. Absolutely not. Did not. Failed to. So that's one of the there's so many if you start to read this timeline, there are so many fascinating aspects to the story. And in the beginning, when I first wrote my first book, A Thousand Years of Revenge, there was negligence and gross negligence. And after a while, when you get to 1996, it starts to really feel like, as somebody described my book, Rory O'Connor, a conspiracy to cover up incompetence. And then you get to what I consider affirmative cover up by some of these senior feds.
Well, before we get there, I wanted to take I don't want to overload our audience with too many names, but there is kind of a really interesting side story with this FBI agent, Nancy Floyd. She
right.
recruited a guy, an Egyptian, to infiltrate the blind sheikh's cell,
right.
paid him some money, and he was going to be their guy on the inside. Take
right.
the story from there.
Yeah, Nancy Floyd was an extraordinary woman. I'm proud to say that until my book, no one had ever told her story. In fact, John Miller, who was a reporter for ABC News. He interviewed bin Laden and later, was on a co-anchor of 2020. John Miller literally is now the chief flack, the chief PR guy for the FBI. Okay, John Miller did a book called The Cell, which is an important book. And it was one of the many books that I read when I was preparing my book, A Thousand Years. But he doesn't even mention Nancy Floyd by name. He tells the Salem story without mentioning it. That's like telling the story of Paul Revere without the horse, you know? Long story short, Nancy Floyd was a kind of a pistol of a young FBI agent from Texas. And she was her role was to do Russian foreign counterintelligence and kind of track these Soviet diplomats at the UN. And she'd go to hotels to see if they were in flagrante delicto. She meets a guy in a hotel north of Times Square called Ahmad Salem. Now, he's a good ex-Egyptian army officer, loyal to America, loves America, falling on hard times. He's making $500 a week. He tells her about the blind sheikh. She recruits him to go undercover. They gave him several weeks. He infiltrates the sheikh's cell in a couple of days. In fact, on my timeline, you'll see a picture of Salem that was in the New York Times, like with the blind sheikh. Within 2 or 3 days, he's walking around as his bodyguard. He's taking him to Detroit to a conference using a van furnished by the FBI. He's going up to Attica. It's on page 6 at the bottom of my timeline, the picture. He's going to Attica where Nasser is trying to foment what they call the 12 Jewish locations plot at the time. They're going to try and blow up some synagogues, et cetera. And he's just vamping because he's an undercover FBI asset, okay? But the deal was that he would never have to wear a wire because he's with these guys on the floor of mosques, et cetera. And then a new head of terrorism comes in named Carson Dunbar. He's an ex-Jersey state trooper. I consider him an empty suit, had no terrorism experience. He felt Nancy, I think, was a threat, a strong woman. He demanded that Salem come to his office, which is insane since the guy's undercover, and literally kind of treated him badly and said, you have to wear a wire. And Salem said, no way, I'm not wearing a wire. So he withdrew. The eyes and ears of the cell withdraws. Cut to Ramzi Youssef, a real bomber, comes in now. The blind sheikh calls Pakistan. They bring in a real bomber, comes in September, starts building this 1,500-pound bomb to put under the World Trade Center on the B-2 level, wants what he calls the Hiroshima event. He wants 250,000 people killed.
Hey, Peter, this is a terrible place to stop, but that music
right.
tells us we need to take a break here, and you need
okay.
to catch a breath anyway. So
sure, absolutely.
We're talking with We're talking with Peter Lance about this evil character, Ali Muhammad, and the book Triple Cross. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more of Coast to Coast AM.